Hello and welcome to Stepping Into Truth. I'm your host Omkari Williams, and I'm very glad you're here with me today. This is the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. If you find these podcasts interesting and you would like to support them and or take a deeper dive into these important subjects, I invite you to join my Patreon community where we do exactly that. Go to patreon.com/omkariwilliams, and you'll also find a link in the episode notes. Now, my guest today is Craig Pomerantz. Craig is an internationally known singer, song stylist, actor, and author. His first children's book, Made by Rafi, has been published in 8 languages and 11 countries to date. Inspired by Made by Rafi, composers Amanda McBroom, Bette Midler's award-winning song The Rose, and Michelle Brouwerman, The Land Before Time series, have written the song Different. You can find it on YouTube and on Craig's YouTube channel. Originally from St. Louis, Missouri, Craig got his professional start at age 12, performing at the Muni, the largest outdoor theater in the country. Craig later attended Carnegie Mellon and the Goodman Theater, which is part of the Art Institute of Chicago. Among his awards are New York's MAC Award for Best Male Vocalist and the Tour Award for Best Actor in a Musical Venue. Craig lives in New York City and travels the world performing in nightclubs and theaters. Right now, he's busy working on his next series of books, hoping to empower children after the success of his first book, Made by Rafi, and I am delighted to welcome Craig to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. I've really been looking forward to this conversation because I have to say, when you first reached out to me about Made by Rafi, I was so intrigued. I loved the concept. It's absolutely charming, and the illustrations are so much fun. But the thing that truly caught my attention was that it was a book for children about bucking gender stereotypes written by a man. And that just isn't something that you see every day. So I'd like to start this conversation by asking you, what made you want to write this book?
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way, because in fact, it was based on an incident that I had with my godson when he was about 8 or 9. And what he had said, this will fall perfectly into what we were chatting about. He had said to me, he has a little bit of a focus problem, and he was a little hyper and all of these things. And originally I had wanted to perhaps give him dance lessons or something to help him physically and focus and all of that. That didn't happen. So I ended up thinking that I would get him knitting needles and yarn, and he started knitting. And he had an hour plus ride from Manhattan to Queens to his school that he went to. And so he started knitting on the bus. And, you know, he was just feeling like very different from the other kids. They were all saying dude and making loud noise. And he was very much more shy and hyper about other things. And he liked music. And at one point he looked, he was having difficulty. And I said, are you okay? And he said, is there such a thing as a Tom girl? And it literally stopped me in my tracks, because I thought to myself, there is no such thing as a Tom girl. But interestingly enough, and which is, I think, I hope will interest you and your listeners, is that it had such a complex idea behind it, because tomboy nowadays is kind of a positive thing. Like, oh, you know, she's assertive and she can do these things and blah, blah, blah. But Tom girl immediately had a sense of negativity to it. And I just thought, why is that? Why is our society so misogynistic that anything feminine seems negative? And that's sort of the conversation started for me.
That's a really interesting way of approaching that, because yeah, it is true. And it's funny, I never thought about Tom girl, and I was certainly a tomboy as a kid. And that was, I felt like that was a positive thing, and that it meant that I was intrepid and all of these other qualities that were very desired in my family, you know, that I was willing to take appropriate risks and I was willing to go out and state my opinion. But if someone had called my brother a Tom girl, I can see that that would have been a serious problem, actually.
And it's interesting because so the book, which encompasses a lot of layers, of course, and is about, you know, what does it mean? What does gender mean and stereotypes and stuff like that? And why do we label things and why do we need labels, of course? But it was interesting because this particular aspect of the book was interesting to me because I have always, and I she'll probably kill me, but I always paraphrase Gloria Steinem because she had said, you know, we've begun to raise our daughters more like sons, but very few have the courage to raise our sons more like daughters. And I just find that so interesting and true. And it's a wonderment to me, like, why, what do girls think? Or what do women think? Why do we think women, I mean, they're, what's wrong with feminine? And it's an interesting question.
Yeah. But it's not a question that you often hear men asking.
No. And in this case, it was not even that. It wasn't even the purpose of the book, because I was writing about a boy who was knitting and was teased, but he was so focused and empowered by his own self and family and the support that he had that he sort of let those things roll off of his back, and he was able to not be a victim to their circumstances. And that's one of the big things about the book. I'm hoping that kids are empowered enough to know that they can try on all sorts of skins to find out who they are, become a whole person, so they won't be bullied or teased, because bullying will always be around. And that's the other, I talk about that a lot. And people want to get rid of bullying, and I'm like, yeah, good luck with that. The only thing you can do is try and help your child or a child you know, or an adult for that matter, become whole enough and self-possessed enough that they don't let themselves be bullied or victims to that.
Yeah, and it's really true because, yes, bullying is going to be around as long as there are people around. Some people are just made that way. They are just kind of, you know, they're just kind of mean. And well, they take their aggressions out on other people.
But I also think it's just a part of people interacting, right? Because everyone, you know, everyone thinks differently about things, and you're sort of testing the waters. And there's a difference between, of course, a dangerous kind of teasing and bullying and just sort of testing the waters where you push the boundaries a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, so.
But it's important, I think, to realize that since that is just part of the dynamic, I mean, I literally can't think of anyone I know who would say that they did not witness or directly experience bullying when they were in elementary school or middle school or even as late as high school in some cases. I mean, we've all either been a victim of it or witnessed it. And that self-possession that you're talking about that makes some people just able to stand there and say, you know, I really don't care what you think. I really don't care what you say. It's not going to impact me. I think that that's a quality that as a society, we are woefully short in. I mean, we're so caught up in being a certain way and fitting into a certain mold. And one of the things about Made by Rafi is that that's exactly what it's talking about. It's talking about breaking that mold and allowing people to really self-express in a way.
It's been a really amazing experience because, as I've often said, I forget how impactful a children's book can be. But when I hear from adults who relate to it, because as you're saying, you know, they all have had that experience at some point in their life. And so everyone understands what this book is about and has their own experience to it. And in what, being in like 8 different languages and all these different countries, I hear from everybody, and that you realize, you know, human nature crosses culture and crosses languages. You know, it's everyone goes through these things. So it's just a question of how you view them, how you manage them, and if you choose to manage them or even view them for that matter, because a lot of people tend to ignore these things. Being self-possessed, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, I think that's a work in progress.
It is.
That's the journey.
That is the journey. You know, and something that I really believe strongly is that we are the product of stories. The stories that we tell ourselves and the stories that our families and our culture tell us. So you came to the story of Rafi through your godson.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether there were stories in your own life, your stories that sort of contributed to that, so that when it got to your godson, all of a sudden it was this tipping point.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the wonderful things for me was to see that my godson was surrounded by support of people so that he could recognize when people were sort of off put by him, but be able to not let it hurt him in ways that it probably hurt me as a child. I started performing when I was very young, and most people, you know, they thought it was strange, and in my community in particular. And I think that, you know, like anything else, my stick-to-itiveness and the fact that I was successful at it, that changed things. You know, that all of a sudden, I think if you're focused enough and you really believe in it enough, then hopefully people start to respect you for your decisions and your choices of how you live your life. I mean, I think that's something to hope for.
And it's something that's really prominent in the book, is that commitment, that personal commitment, really does shift the world around us. Because people respond to that. They recognize that as something larger than just an idea of how we're supposed to be. They recognize the truth of it, and they respond to that. And it's also not only liberating for the person who is, in quotes, different, but for the people around them to witness and say, oh, I actually have some more freedom here than I realized I had.
It's also an example, I think, of how ignorance is such a big part of it. You know, it's really, you know, that people don't understand, so that if they can start to understand, then they can say, oh, it makes sense to me. And then they're not, the fear of the unknown is like obliterated, you know. Yeah. It's like and that's why one of the most wonderful things I find in the book is when his mother says to him in the book, you are your own special person, you are Rafi, and we are proud of you for who you are.
Yeah.
You know, it just speaks of, like, you know, exactly the right kind of support.
And it's funny, because I don't think that there is ever an age that we attain where hearing those words is not meaningful for us.
Oh, my God.
You know?
No, absolutely. You know, and it's, I mean, my mother passed away last year, and it's a hard, that's a hard thing. I mean,
yes, it is.
When anyone passes away, but it's a hard thing. But it's interesting to me, because when something happens, you so often think, you get something successful happens, you know, and you're just like, the first thing you want to do is like, oh, my mom would have loved to have known this. You know?
Yes.
It's, you know, it's how we are.
We are made for connection, and where we find those connections is really important. And those connections really do shape us. And it's one of the messages of your book, you know, looking at how Rafi changes the dynamics in his class at school just by being himself, and
exactly.
How really beautiful that is to witness. Something that we had, before we got on this call, talked about that we wanted to discuss was the subject of toxic masculinity, because I feel like part of what the whole story of Rafi is refuting this notion of masculinity that is so narrow and so rigid that knitting is seen as outside the bounds of it. And what happens when we narrow that? I mean, here we are, from Brett Kavanaugh to R. Kelly, we've been watching powerful men shift a narrative away from abuse and avoid addressing this underlying issue of why are so many men allowed to behave in ways that are so heinous and so harmful, and the culture kind of just turns a blind eye to it. And I'm curious, you know, I have my take as a woman, but I'm curious as to what your take on it is from your perspective.
It's so hard to understand, and I don't, you know, I mean, I think that, I mean, I guess it's not from a very black and white viewpoint, not hard to understand when you think about, you know, the way that advertising is and the way that movies present themselves and the way we grow up with these ideas and these labels. Although, like in the book, like, what's funny about this idea that he's knitting and that people think it's strange, I mean, ultimately, like, the most famous designers and knitters in the world are like men, right? It's like cooking. Like, my next book was going to be Rafi baking, you know, and people are going to make fun of him for baking. Well, most famous chefs in the world are men. Why that should be, I don't know. But, you know, I don't know where it comes from, because it was so far removed from how I was raised. I mean, I just have always been so respectful of, and everyone I know so few people who have that edge to them of like, I need to fight for this concept that I'm a man, mm-hmm. whatever that might be. And I've just never been able to understand it. And when I see it, it's always been sort of frightening to me. And I don't understand it. So I don't know how I can tell you about it, because I don't know that many people. And then when I meet people, I mean, although, you know, I've met Donald Trump, for instance, and people like that. And I mean, it's hard to fathom the self-centeredness and fear in those people that they have to maintain this idea. But it seems to me very fearful.
I would have to agree. I think that kind of behavior definitely comes from a place of deep fear and deep insecurity.
Proving something, and I, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But I wonder if, and this is not to let anyone off the hook here at all, but I'm wondering if it's one of those things where when we encounter it, it is so powerful and astonishing that we tend to think of it in broader terms than maybe we should. And maybe it's a more specific problem than we are actually thinking about, and that in itself, that giving it that broad range diminishes our ability to really address the issue. Because if we look at it and we go, well, you know, that's just how men are, then we kind of miss our opportunity to look at, well, that's not how all men are.
But the question is why? And I don't know how we get those answers, because I often wonder where the mothers and the sisters and the daughters involved in seeing this behavior develop as well, if in old-fashioned terms the mother is around more raising the son. I don't know. And like, where is the father involved? And it's hard to understand, which is why you tend to think, well, it's all about how people are reading, what they're reading, and the TV, and what the TV tells them, and games, you know, computer games, what they're telling them, except that they have to have their own mind when they come to these things.
And this is not a new thing. I mean, I think that we are in this environment right now where we want answers to things that are simple and make the solution simple. And we're not in that place, because I think that the underlying thing of toxic masculinity is a society that A, values masculine over feminine.
Right.
And B, that values a very narrow definition of masculine over other definitions. So you have this white patriarchal society that feels, I think, particularly under siege right now, because frankly, it is. Mm-hmm. And that this, what we're experiencing, may well be a result or a reaction, a response to the fact that people are starting to question whether the status quo actually has validity, and whether it's something that should be sustained, or whether we need to look at very different ways of living in the world, which would be my argument. My argument would be that white patriarchy works for a tiny, tiny percentage of people and is devastating to the vast majority of people, and that we need to shift our understanding of what the dynamics of a healthy society are from the ground up.
Well, and then we're going back to that idea we talked about earlier, which is, why is feminine a negative thing? I mean, because it's an interesting, some of the thing, and maybe you can help me, my perspective may not be so clear on this, but it's interesting to me, all these new movies that are being made with women doing these. And I mean, I haven't seen a lot of them, and I'm sure some of them are wonderful and fun. But what's interesting to me is, so we're remaking movies that gave us bad ideas and interpretations of men so that women can be more like men. Like, so have we not really understood? Like, I'm all for making movies and doing, but why aren't they making movies that are empowering women in a different way? Not that they have to be more like men. Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. I mean, look, I went and saw Wonder Woman and I completely enjoyed it. I did. Yeah. And at the same time, that is a story of a woman taking on what it has been a traditional male role and succeeding in that role, which is part of the reason that it was really applauded by so many women. It's, you know, to see a powerful woman is great. But your point is really well taken. We're seeing a woman basically do what men do as if that is the be all and the end all. And that, to me, is the underlying story that we need to break away from. We need to shift the whole story of what does success look like? What does it mean to be successful? What does it mean to be a good human?
And women have stories, have wonderful stories that are all about women that have nothing to do with replacing the idea of, like, if this were a man, it would be the same story. That's what interests me. And I mean, listen, I don't believe in a lot of gender issues, differences. I really don't, other than, and which is part of the reason this book works for me. I mean, I think that we're people and human beings and human, and you just, as I said earlier, you try on a lot of different skins and then you find out who you are. And it's not easy because you have everyone around you saying, well, no, but that's the wrong outfit.
You know? Right.
So you have to, but, and then you have to sort of stick to your guns and say, well, but that's the outfit I want to wear this week, you know? Mm-hmm. The male versus female thing is a real mystery. And I don't know. And I'm lucky enough to be sheltered enough that the people that I know don't fall into those categories so much. So they don't, they're not as judgmental or they're not as label focused on these things. So the communication is not difficult. And it's fascinating to me that there's still this idea that men can't communicate and, you know, and women can. And I think that given the chance that everyone can communicate with each other and everything would be great. You know, I mean, you don't have to agree, but at least you have the dialogue.
Yeah, I think that the challenge really comes in for a lot of people in that we are raised with such specific ideas of who we're supposed to be. Most of us, not all of us, but the majority of us, you know, this is what boys do. This is what girls do. I mean, I think that that is shifting, but still, you know, given that we spend most of our time away from our parents, where, you know, once we get to school age, and so there, the influences that are coming at us are societal influences, and those roles are still so clearly defined. I mean, you look at television and you see how clearly defined the roles are. You know, a commercial tells you exactly what you're supposed to be doing in the world. Are you running and jumping? You're a guy. Are you, you know, are you dancing? You're a girl. I mean, it's just, it's so narrow. And when we're in those positions of having that information constantly saturating us, it gets really hard to hear our own voices, which is why I love that this book is in the world, because it is a book that is, to me, affirming of hearing your own voice. And not being that concerned with what other people have to say, which is hard.
And the idea of just embracing a difference, whatever that difference is, and embracing it. And even if you, now, Rafi was lucky enough to have the support, but other people, you start to embrace your differences, you'll find support as well if you give it a try and not be afraid of doing that.
Yeah.
But you have to step out. You have to step out into the world and be an active part to make that happen for yourself.
And I think that that's where a lot of people get stuck, because that feels very frightening for a lot of people.
And it is frightening.
Yeah, with good reason.
You know, well, I'm always sort of amazed. You know, life is for the living. Like, life is for, and it's not, I understand that it's not easy for people. I mean, I know people who are very isolated. They choose to be isolated. It's like, you know, I try and encourage them. It's like, you know, you got to get out there. You know, it's, and who knows what you'll find.
You know, but that's what gets scary for people, is the who knows what you'll find part. You know,
yeah,
it's like, there could be alligators out there. You never know.
Yeah. There's so many aspects of the book that are interesting to me. And that whole concept of empathy, which I love. And when you put a book out there and you have an idea of what you're trying to say, and then you hear from everybody else their ideas of what they see in the book. I mean, I get letters from and emails rather from parents who say from reading the book, they discovered that their kid was in fact the bully. And I find that fascinating. I don't know how they deal with that, but at least they become aware of these things themselves. So I think that it's part of the conversation, part of the dialogue of putting yourself out there to find out all the layers and textures that are available to you.
I think that that's remarkable, actually, that parents read the book and realize that their kid is the bully, because so often parents don't want to think anything bad about their children, which one understands, but that your book is actually getting people to look reality square in the face. And then it gives them an opportunity to make a difference and make a change. Because if you don't acknowledge that your kid is a bully, then there's very little hope of changing that dynamic.
Absolutely.
So I think that's really cool. And kudos to you, and kudos to those parents as well.
Absolutely. And I, as I said, I was quite surprised by the first time I got that notice. But I thought to myself, as you were saying, oh, my God, I hope that this person really knows how to handle that idea. Because the other issues involved about in life and in this book that I talk about, and it's this whole concept of protecting your children. And I often say, we don't want anything violent or terrible to happen, but you can't really protect your child. You know, you can only try and make them as whole of a human being as possible and let them live their life by example and let things happen to them.
Yeah.
You know, and too much protection is equally as limiting as any label they get when they go out into the world.
I think that's really true. And I actually think that that is something that's happened a lot in the last, I'm going to say 20 years, that people have gotten hyper protective of their children, and that has actually lowered our kids' ability to be resilient in the world.
That's a really the perfect word. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, and that's not what anyone wants for their kids. Everyone wants their kids to be able to bounce back from the hard knocks that life is inevitably going to dish out. Because if you can't do it as a kid, where are you going to learn to do it so that when you're an adult and it gets incredibly tough in different ways, that skill isn't there. And I think that something that really struck me in the book was that quality of resilience in Rafi.
And how you learn about relationships. This is how you learn about relationships and how important relationships are if you do them correctly.
Yeah. And also, even if you do them incorrectly, you learn something. It's like, oh, know what? The little bullies in the book learned something.
Yeah.
And that shifted them. And that's all we can hope for, I think, is to keep learning throughout life. And if we're doing that, then everything else seems like it will sort itself out. But it's that getting stuck and being rigid about an idea, which is, again, how we get into the whole gender stereotype. This absolutely is how a boy has to be. This is how a girl has to be. Or any other place where we decide that there is one way of doing something. Once we're there, we're stuck.
And it's a dilemma because, parents, we're talking about they want to protect their kids and themselves. I mean, let's also be truthful. A lot of a child being different is about the reflection it has on the adult.
Absolutely.
And so to sit there and sort of say, I'm going to let go of that because of however important things are to you. But there's also this idea that I feel like I repeat myself too much, but there's this idea of protecting your child, letting your child be who they are in a way, and then then negating it. And what I mean by that is that I've had conversations with friends who, for instance, they have a young son who, wants to wear high heels at home, and the parents are like, go ahead, wear high heels at home, blah, blah, blah. And they're fine with that. But then they're like, but when you go out into the world, you can't wear high heels. And they don't see how that is an immediate, that's a much more negative statement to the child than letting them just wear the high heels.
Yeah. It's actually, in my opinion, worse than not letting them wear them at all. It's like,
First of all, it puts much more focus on it. It makes it a really negative thing. Like, oh, I see. So the world is about secrets at home.
Exactly.
And the real world and stuff
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. Basically teaching someone to lie about who they are.
Yes. And it's hard enough. It's hard enough that the thing that we can all probably agree on is the concept. And this is I've had this conversation many times where you say this and people just burst into tears. To say to somebody, you deserve to be loved, is the hardest concept in the world for people. People just like, they don't believe it. And if you were, you know, when someone says to you, you deserve to be loved, it's a really incredibly emotional thing because most people don't believe it.
Yeah. I've had that same experience where you say that to someone, to a grown man, and you can see the tears welling up in his eyes. Yeah. And that always breaks my heart because then I feel like I'm looking at the child. And the child that wasn't allowed to be who they were and was told that who they were wasn't good enough or whatever. And so they've put on this facade. And then you say something like that to them and there's this place in them that just breaks open.
Yeah.
And it's painful and it's also beautiful because
it means a good pain.
Yeah. It means there's possibility still there.
Yeah. And it really opens up the idea that, you know, that they recognize also that they really recognize something that hasn't perhaps or isn't perhaps verbalized enough for them, you know, and sometimes a lot of times you just need to hear things out loud to move forward.
And to also sometimes you need to hear things out loud to know what you think, you know?
I'm a great believer in venting.
Yes, exactly. It's like, oh, okay, well, I actually didn't know I thought that, but now I feel so much better for having said that. And I realize I really do think that.
Yeah.
So I have a couple of other questions for you. And one of them is, okay, so I'm a native of Manhattan. And yay. And one of the things that I've long been aware of is that people often think that bigotry and discrimination are not things that people in big East and West Coast cities have to deal with. And you're from the Midwest, and people tend to think that people from that region of the country are inherently more conservative, inherently more rigid. And I'm curious as to whether that has actually been your experience.
Well, there's so many aspects of that question. So it's interesting because in St. Louis, I was raised in an extremely liberal environment. But interestingly enough, I'm back in touch with a friend of mine from high school, a black girl from high school who now lives in Pennsylvania, actually, very brilliant, smart, wonderful woman whom I always adored. And I had, when all of this stuff came up, we met recently actually at a party that I had. And I said to her, was it weird going to a school that was mostly rich white kids? And she said, you know, when I first moved to St. Louis, around 10 years old, my father took me to a gun range to teach me how to shoot a gun. And I was like, really? I was completely shocked by that. And then she said, but then we moved to that school district and it was much more progressive and it was much easier. So no, I didn't have a problem. But she said, but you know something? I was never invited to one party, one bar mitzvah, one anything, you know, anything like that, not one. And I was really shocked by that, really shocked. So it was interesting to find that out. And I didn't know her when I was having those kinds of parties because it wouldn't have occurred to me not to invite her. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to know that. And then coming to New York, you know, the weirdest thing, and this is the kind of thing I probably shouldn't say in a podcast. It's really strange living in a city that so hates the person in charge of our government. I mean,
that's fine. You can say that.
It is unbelievable. If you walk the streets, and I mean, there are so few people that can bear what this administration is all about. So it's really odd, and a lot of things are heightened here. But you know, it's the great thing about any city is that you are forced to live among people, so you come across everybody. You know, and there are other reasons not to like somebody. It has nothing to do with their gender, or you know, it could be a lot of other things, or race and stuff like that. So. I don't know if that answers your question completely.
Yeah, that's a good answer because I often think that people don't understand the dynamics of big cities on the coasts, you know.
Well, not just on the coast, big cities in general. I mean, if you were in St. Louis, because it's interesting, the Ferguson thing that happened in St. Louis has nothing to do with the St. Louis that I grew up in. So it's very hard for me to understand it. You know, it's like 2 hours away from where I lived. So it's not really St. Louis. So it's hard for me to understand. But you're in Savannah, right?
I'm in Savannah, yeah.
Which is Southern, so you got a lot of I don't want to judge, but it seems to me a rather perhaps Southern conservative area.
It's interesting because in some ways Savannah feels like a tiny, tiny big city because mm-hmm. it is a very progressive city. And so it doesn't feel that different in some ways than New York did. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you are definitely in the South. And there are those experiences that are specifically Southern. And there is a sense of a good, you know, a well-entrenched good old boys club that I had not encountered in New York ever in that way.
That's interesting.
It shapes the dynamics of how things happen in the city to some extent. But again, it's a progressive city. Savannah went 70% for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election.
Right, of course.
Now, that's probably the only city in Georgia that did that. We're a tiny city, but it is a very interesting dynamic. And Savannah is also a majority minority city. Most of the occupants of Savannah are Black.
Okay.
And that is, so there's this dynamic that happens here that I actually didn't even experience in New York, where people just have figured out ways of getting along because you are in a small city, but it is an incredibly diverse city with a lot of different influences, a lot of different cultural influences.
But is it silently or is it an active participant? You know,
it's pretty active. I mean, it's actually surprisingly active. And the exchanges between the different groups are actually quite intentional and active. And there are dividing lines, but it is not really what I would have thought of as a Southern city. So it made me shift my mindset about what a small city might be like relative to a big city. Right. And that was a good thing because I was a little bit of a big city snob, I have to be honest. You know, when you grow up in Manhattan, you're completely convinced that that is the center of the universe. Completely.
And when you move, you're the same. Well, it's interesting because now that we're thinking about this and talking about this, because when I'm in St. Louis, I was raised in an Orthodox Jewish community. So, and when I was a kid, I saw a KKK meeting at a church, and it was really frightening to me. And I was hiding in the bushes, and I will never forget it. And that shaped a lot of my experiences and understanding about race and stuff like that, and how frightening and how Southern, because St. Louis is rather a Southern town.
It is a Southern city in most ways, I find. Yeah. It to be so. And it's interesting because those cultural influences also have a lot of impact on gender roles. I mean, you know, something that is really, I still don't quite get here is high school football is a big deal. Yeah. I mean, it's a big deal. They have it on TV on Friday nights. What? I mean, are you kidding? This is completely foreign to me. But it does tend to shape how often you see young men engaging with each other. And that was really surprising to me. But on the other hand, there's this thing here where everyone calls everyone ma'am and sir. Mm-hmm. And they're not doing it just to be. That's just, they are doing it for real. And there is a real sense of, that's how you show respect. And that is a serious thing. So there are these interesting ways in which societal roles and gender roles are all kind of mixed up in ways that you might not necessarily expect. And yet you can find yourself in this position where in Savannah, if you are a female and you are acting sort of really tomboyish, don't be surprised if a perfect stranger walking down the street says something to you and tells you to act like a lady.
Yeah.
Usually they're an older person, but it's still something that you will occasionally see. And that to me is challenging because I always want to say, no, leave that child alone to be who they are.
Yeah.
You know? But I also don't really want to get into an argument with total strangers.
In Manhattan, it's a lot more engaged in ways that somehow are not easy, because it seems so easy to say, you know, why let the baby cry. It's a baby. It's allowed to cry. You don't have, you know, you can't stop it in the way you're doing, or whatever the situation might be. I totally understand that. But the great thing, it sounds like, is, I mean, of course, it's all depends on the person and who you are, and you're out in the world and you're just living your life and seeing all these different things without judgment. Therefore, you can incorporate them in a way that makes sense. And that's a good thing. But it's when it confronts you in a way that they're trying to stop behavior or demand a certain kind of behavior, that's when it gets difficult.
And that is the challenge right now, because I think that even with all the focus on people being gender fluid and not having to put themselves into a specific box, I think that that is still, to an overwhelming degree, the minority opinion, and that people are still trying to make kids be a certain way because that's what makes them comfortable, and that's what makes them feel like they're protecting their child.
Would bring up another topic, which we probably don't have time to go into. But you know, it's a wonderful thing, this new idea of gender fluidness and understanding it and understanding who we are and stuff like that. But now we live in a world where children are asked at such a young age to make a label for themselves instead of the concept of gender fluidity, instead of letting a child grow through his or her life and figure out who they are. It's like all of a sudden at a very young age, someone's saying, well, you have to tell me this or that.
Yeah.
And it's when when a child makes that choice, it's not easy to go back once you've made that, because everyone reacts a certain way. And then it's a very difficult concept for a lot of people. And I only want people to be supported and loved for who they are. But as a way of protection, I like, you know, can't you sort of live your life and learn by living your life, not stopping your life short by putting your label on yourself, limiting yourself already.
I wonder if we're going to get to a point where, and I hope we do actually get to a point where children are they, you know, rather than he, she, him, her, you know, until they decide where they are on that. And we just use the neutral they, and let that be the norm. And just, if we get to that place, then I think maybe we'll be in a place where we're not telling people who they have to be or what that is.
How they have to be.
Because, you know, even if you, you know, no matter what your identity is, it shouldn't mean that there's a whole bunch of ways of being that come with that.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm hopeful. And one thing I really do take heart from is when I engage with my friends' younger children, they have no problem with someone else's gender identity not being locked in. They don't have a problem with it.
The pricelessness of innocence.
Yes.
Is just, you know, it's just beyond, because, you know, the fact that Rafi could invent this word tomgirl at age 8 or 9 is a good example of like just the innocence that comes with that question.
Yes.
You know, and the openness of like, okay, this is a question. Help me, you know, can you understand it? Can I understand it? It's like, yeah, that's what the world is about. You question your life, you move out there and you experience these things, and you know, the truth will set you free and you will find your authentic self, whatever that might be.
Yeah. Without having to give a specific label to it. So let me ask you one final question.
Sure.
I am wondering whether you have a vision for where this story, Rafi's story, and the book you're working, the next book and whatever future books need to go in terms of the realm of education. Are these books that you plan to try and move into school systems or...
I would love them to be in schools, and I would love them to be obviously the first places that buy the book tend to be libraries. So I love that, and that's what I hope for. And my next book that I'm doing a Rafi book, but the one book that I'm really, really want out there is a book I call My Face is Funny. And it's about a little girl whose ears stick out and she thinks her face is funny. And then, but by the end of the book, she realizes that everyone's face is funny, you know?
And it's
like, you know, I just think we live in an age where young girls like putting on makeup and trying to look a certain way and getting, you know, nose jobs at a young age and body image. I just think it's so important again to love who you are as who you are. And if you want to make changes as you get older, I'm all for that. But yeah, I just think that, you know, you have to give the support for them to love themselves, who they are. And I think that's a good change for everybody.
I could not agree more. And actually, I think that the syndrome you describe of young girls having surgical procedures to shape their bodies in ways that their bodies just aren't naturally is essentially toxic femininity. And that notion that girls are there to be pleasing to the eye of someone else rather than just being in their own bodies and having that be perfect as it is so damaging. And so I love that you're going to do a book about a girl whose ears stick out. That's just, yeah, that's great. Yeah. So, well, this conversation has been really lovely and I'm so glad we had an opportunity to talk, and I just want to thank you so much. And I'm really looking forward to the next book. So thank you, Craig.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Good. Made by Rafi can be found on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all book retailer sites. And you will be able to find out where you can contact Craig Pomerantz on his website, craigpomerantz.com. All of this will be in the episode notes. And I want to thank you for joining me for this episode of Stepping Into Truth. If you enjoyed what you heard, I invite you to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Each positive review helps new listeners find us. I'll be back with another episode very soon. And until then, remember, change starts with story, so keep sharing yours.